From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Basil Valentine and Compass on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Today is Monday, the 6th of November, and welcome to Compass with me, Basil Valentine, the voice of sanity. This is your World News Hour here on today's News Talk. In today's program, we will have the latest from the humanitarian crisis in the Middle East and the latest diplomatic developments with United States Secretary of State Tony Blinken wrapping up his visit to Turkey. But first, some of the other stories making the headlines as we go around the compass. Reports from Moscow are that Vladimir Putin has decided to run in the March presidential election, a move that will keep him in power until at least 2030, as the Kremlin chief feels he must steer Russia through this most perilous period in decades. Putin, who turned 71 last month, was handed the presidency by Boris Yeltsin on the last day of the last century, and he has already served as president for longer than any other Russian ruler since Joseph Stalin, beating even Leonid Brezhnev's 18-year tenure. Sources who spoke to Reuters on condition of anonymity due to the sensitivity of Kremlin politics said that news of Putin's decision had trickled down and that advisers are now preparing for the campaign and a subsequent Putin election. For Putin, who opinion polls show enjoying approval ratings of 80% inside Russia, the election is a formality if he runs. With the support of the state media, and almost no mainstream public dissent, he is certain to win. However, that decision, whether or not he runs, is yet to be finalised. A choreographed hint is due to come within weeks, confirming a Kommersant newspaper report last month. Another source, also acquainted with the Kremlin's thinking, confirmed that a decision had been made and that Putin's advisers are indeed preparing for his participation. Three other sources said the decision has been made. Putin will run. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov declined to comment. Peskov said in September that if Putin decided to run, then no one would be able to compete with him. The Kremlin has also dismissed reports that Putin is unwell as disinformation spread by the West. While Putin may face no real competition in the election, the former KGB spy faces the most serious set of challenges any Kremlin chief has faced since Mikhail Gorbachev grappled with the crumbling Soviet Union more than three decades ago, with the war in the Ukraine being his biggest headache. Indeed, just this morning, Ukraine has announced that Russian attacks were repelled across the front lines in the south and east over the past week. Ukraine said 400 individual combat clashes took place over the last 7 days, and Russia continues its offensive on Advivka, an industrial town in the eastern region of Donetsk, which it has been trying to surround and capture for months. The enemy is conducting assault actions in several directions at once, said Andriy Kovalyov, a spokesperson for the General Staff of Ukraine's Armed Forces, on state television. Kovalyov also reported Russian attacks near the village of Robotin, which Ukraine regained control of earlier this year in the southern Zaporizhia region. The enemy attempted to restore its lost position near Robotin, but it had no success, Kovalyov said. Ukraine's Kovalyov added that offensive operations are underway south of Bakhmut, a city destroyed by months of artillery fire and urban warfare before Russia eventually captured it in May. The latest now from Ukraine in this report.
At this hospital in Kyiv, they are all set for a second winter at war. The basement air raid shelter, able to accommodate 200, has just been renovated. It has its own well to provide a source of clean drinking water in case the main supply fails. And it now has a third generator to ensure a constant electricity supply.
The power cuts were quite frequent in the area last year, but the medical facilities were the last ones to be turned off, and when they were, our generators coped with the situation.
As the cold weather sets in, Ukraine has been strengthening the resilience of hospitals and other essential facilities.
As temperatures continue to fall, the authorities believe it's only a matter of time before Russia launches an all-out attack on Ukraine's energy system, as it did last winter. And it's not only the big cities that are preparing for the onslaught. Even the smallest of villages are getting ready.
To the north of Kyiv, the village of Moshon saw some of the fiercest fighting of the invasion, when Russian forces were stopped here and then forced to retreat. Yuri Yushchenko, like other residents, is preparing his store of firewood. His home, like many others, was destroyed in the fighting. It will need to be completely rebuilt, he tells us. Last year, he and his neighbors had to shiver through the winter in plastic container homes. This winter, they have better temporary houses that he aims to improve further by installing a wood burner. Measures both big and small to help Ukrainians resist the double threats posed by Russia and winter. Rob McBride, Al Jazeera, Kyiv.
Chinese state media is reporting that China's President Xi Jinping has today met Cuban Prime Minister Manuel Marrero at Beijing's Great Hall of the People, a day after the Cuban leader signed cooperation documents with Xi's deputy at a trade fair. Marrero comes to China as Cuba's economy, which is heavily dependent on food, fuel and other imports, is close to collapse following a more than 50% decline in its export earnings, which are needed to purchase imports. Marrero was among half a dozen foreign dignitaries attending the opening ceremony of the International Import Expo, the CIIE, on Sunday in Shanghai, a week-long trade fair where countries and companies often strike deals, resulting in the world's second-largest economy buying more of their wares. Following the meeting between Marrero and China's President Li Qiang on the sidelines of the CIIE, Chinese and Cuban officials signed several unspecified cooperation documents, according to a summary of the meeting published by Chinese state media. Also in China, Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese told Chinese President Xi Jinping that Australia has an interest in the continued stable growth of China's economy and its ongoing engagement in the world. In opening remarks, as the two leaders met at the Great Hall of the People, Albanese said a strong relationship between the two countries is beneficial into the future. Australia, along with other countries in the region, has an interest in continued stable growth in the Chinese economy and its ongoing engagement in the world, he said. This according to an official transcript from the Australian Prime Minister's office. Details now in this report from Al Jazeera.
Anthony Albanese is the first Australian Prime Minister to visit China since 2016. His four-day trip is aimed at easing years of diplomatic strain between the two countries. Albanese was a guest of honour at China's Import-Export Expo that's opened in Shanghai.
It is in all our interest to have a relationship where there is dialogue and cooperation.
Tensions were sparked in 2018 when the previous Australian government banned Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G network and called for an investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. Beijing responded by imposing a diplomatic freeze and trade curbs on Australian imports.
And the democratic process.
Elected in 2022, Albanese has sought to improve ties with Canberra's biggest trading partner. In recent months, Beijing has removed tariffs on wheat and barley.
My mom.
And released Australian journalist Chung Lei after 3 years of detention on spying charges. But significant differences remain.
Australia continues to deepen its relationship with the United States, and Australia continues to have a really high threat perception when it comes to the Chinese government and its activities on the world stage.
China has criticized Australia's plan to purchase nuclear-powered submarines from the US and its joining of the so-called Quad Security Pact that also includes India and Japan. Beijing hopes repairing ties with Australia will prevent it from following Washington's tough toward China approach too closely. It's also expected to push for Canberra's support in signing up to the CPTPP trade pact for countries linked by the Pacific Ocean. Anthony Albanese is scheduled to travel to Beijing and meet Chinese President Xi Jinping on Monday. Katrina Yu, Al Jazeera, Beijing.
More than 150 people have been killed after an earthquake struck remote western Nepal on Friday. Security forces have been deployed to help rescue efforts in the rugged districts of Jajarkot and West Rukum, 500 kilometers west of Kathmandu. Strong tremors were felt far away in the Nepalese capital and in cities in neighboring India, including in Delhi. The government said about 375 people had been injured. Jajarkot's hospital is packed with the wounded, as we can hear now in this report.
A magnitude 6.4 earthquake shook western Nepal on Friday. The tremors were felt in the capital Kathmandu and as far away as New Delhi. The districts of Jajarkot and Rukum West in the remote Karnali province were hardest hit. Many people spent the night outside in the cold.
I was asleep when I suddenly felt the shaking. I got up and tried to run, but was caught in the collapsing debris.
The Prime Minister and several MPs flew in to assess the damage and offer their condolences to affected communities. They were accompanied by medical teams from the army.
Our primary focus is to rescue the injured, provide treatment and distribute relief materials. All the teams are working hard.
As local hospitals struggle to treat the injured, health personnel from other parts of the country have been deployed as reinforcements. Dozens of severely injured have been airlifted to bigger hospitals in nearby towns.
Nepal is among the most vulnerable countries to earthquakes as the tectonic plates beneath its young mountains continue to shift in their formation. Earthquakes are increasingly being felt across the country.
Jajarkot and Rukum West are in a remote and underdeveloped part of Nepal, making search and rescue operations challenging.
The remoteness of the area, in the scattered nature of the villages, habitats. So these are creating a little bit challenge to the troops.
As winter approaches, authorities have appealed to international humanitarian organizations to help with relief efforts. Ramyatha Limbu, Al Jazeera, Kathmandu.
Nicaragua has pardoned 21 Honduran prisoners and returned them to its northern neighbor, including a leader of the Mara Salvatrucha MS-13 criminal gang, who was detained immediately upon crossing the border, Honduran police announced yesterday. Nicaragua also plans to return prisoners to Costa Rica, the government of its southern neighbor said at the weekend. A similar transfer on October the 18th involved 43 Honduran prisoners. Nicaragua has not disclosed reasons for its actions. Sunday's transfer involved David Elias Campbell Licona, known as El Viejo Dan, who was leader of MS-13, a gang that originated in Los Angeles, operates in the United States, and controls territory throughout Central America. Campbell Licona had been wanted by Honduran authorities on money laundering and gang charges since 2016 and was captured in Nicaragua in June 2021. He was sanctioned in February this year by the United States, where he is wanted for possession of firearms and faces conspiracy charges, including murder and the importation of cocaine. We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, the latest from the crisis in the Middle East. We'll be right back after this short break.
You should hear what Lynn Shaw is talking about.
Your kids, our youth, are seeing the worst of humanity because if they have unlimited, unfiltered, unmonitored access to the internet, this is what they are seeing. This is the truth. So I urge all of you, think about all of this. Take actions. Think about what you can control in your own home, in your environment, in your community. When I have somebody say to me, a parent, I don't want to open that can of worms. It's going to lead them into doing, asking more questions or looking at porn. Let me tell you something. These kids are smart. These kids are savvy. They are already seeing it, hearing about it. And even if you do everything correctly, I am here to tell you, their friends will show them something. So we want to empower. It's not just, no, 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 you can't do this. Talking to them. Here's how we're all staying safe. Here is how we're going to put our devices down, I don't know, every day for 15 minutes. That is up to you. You have parental autonomy.
Lynn Shaw on TNT Radio.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. News talk radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT radio listeners rely on TNT radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
You're listening to Compass with Basil Valentine on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
With senile Joe Blinken sidelined and utterly ineffectual, the man many observers say is running the United States, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, has just finished his meeting with his Turkish counterpart Hakan Fidan. As of now, there has been no joint statement, but sources are informed that they discussed several issues, particularly the war in Gaza and a possible upcoming exchange of prisoners. Jordan airdropped medical supplies recently required by the Kingdom's field hospital in besieged Gaza on Sunday night, according to the Jordanian king and state media. Our fearless Air Force personnel airdropped at midnight urgical medical aid to the Jordanian field hospital in Gaza. This is our duty to aid our brothers and sisters injured in the war. We will always be there for our Palestinian brethren, King Abdullah II said in a post on X, formerly known as Twitter. Last week, Jordan recalled its ambassador to Israel and told the Israeli ambassador to stay away in protest at the bombardment of Gaza, saying the attacks had killed innocents and caused a humanitarian catastrophe. Overnight, there has been a particularly heavy bombardment of the Gaza Strip, including the cancer ward of a children's hospital. Casualties now run to well over 20,000, with an estimated 6,000 children now having been massacred. In northern Gaza, the stench of rotting corpses buried under the rubble is everywhere, and the catastrophe only worsens by the day, as we can hear now.
This is an avalanche of human suffering that's 100% man-made. It is the worst humanitarian catastrophe I've experienced in my lifetime and in my growingly long career in humanitarian medicine. And it's burning through the hearts of every single humanitarian that I know. You know, I'm going to paint a picture for you of the degree of suffering that we're seeing. People keep asking me about medical aid and hospitals and the situation of the hospitals. The entire hospital healthcare system collapsed almost a week ago. It was announced on TV for the whole world to see. And in that week, there has been indiscriminate bombardment. And I don't even know if indiscriminate is the right term, because it's targeting healthcare facilities, ambulances, churches, mosques, schools, refugee camps, densely populated refugee camps, wiping out entire families in a second, entire multi-generational extended families in a second. There are almost 1,000 families in the Gaza Strip who have had at least two members of their family, at least two members, killed in the last 3 weeks. There are almost 4,000 children who have been killed and identified, excluding almost 1,000 children whose bodies are still trapped under the rubble. Some of them may be alive for a long period before they ultimately die under the rubble. And I'm sorry if there are any young, you know, children watching this. Perhaps this is a good time to ask them to leave the room. But I think it's important that I paint a picture, particularly when I'm following a news narrative that almost dismisses this avalanche of suffering that is unprecedented in modern times. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an acronym in the Gaza Strip right now. You know, I'm a pediatric intensive care doctor. I see a lot of suffering in my career. There's an acronym that is unique to the Gaza Strip, and it's WCNSF, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. Children, and it is used not infrequently in the last 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. It was coined in the last three weeks. One physician told me a few days ago that a little girl came in wounded, and she had a piece of paper in her pocket that she handed to him. He sent me a picture of the piece of paper. It had 27 names on it. And she said, "These are the members of my family that were with me in my home. Please look for them. Please look for them under the rubble. Don't look for this one." And she points to the name of her sister. "I know she's already dead." This is a 10-year-old little girl. Wounded Child, No Surviving Family should not exist as an acronym. And to follow President Biden as he continues to justify and to warmonger, All I can say is this has to stop. It's a collective stain on our humanity. It's a stain on our collective humanity.
Tanya, let me ask you, you paint such a vivid and horrific picture. You really do. And I understand that these are your friends who you've worked with and how difficult that must be. You're not alone. I've been hearing today from reading testimony today from Philip Lazzarini, who's the Commissioner General of UNRWA. He's been speaking to the UN Security Council. He said this: the sanitary conditions are appalling. People live on very little bread and whatever is left of some water. 70 of their staff members have been killed, and they are looking after 670,000 people in their refugee centres. Is there any sign from what you're hearing that of a humanitarian pause or pauses that could be negotiated?
I'm not a politician, but the word pause to me makes no sense. You know, you pause to nourish and hydrate a population before you kill them. It just doesn't make any sense for me. You stop the bombardment. That is what the entire global community should be pushing for and should be insisting on. You know, and I think in leading up to my introduction, I think you interviewed somebody who said something very similar, a Gazan who said something very similar. You know, the priority is not giving us aid. You need to stop the indiscriminate bombardment. So I think, yes, what is needed is a humanitarian truce or a ceasefire, global intervention, things that were voted for by the overwhelming majority of countries on this planet a few days ago in the General Assembly of the United Nations, yet they're not adhered to and are completely disregarded by the powers that be. Two powers, to be specific.
Those powers, of course, being the United States and Israel. Reports from Istanbul are that the United States side has tried to convince Turkish officials to put more pressure on Hamas and make it release the captives. But the Turkish position is very clear on this matter. They say that prisoner release should be mutual, where Hamas releases captives and Israel releases Palestinian prisoners. Turkey also asked for an unconditional ceasefire and said there should be an international mechanism to observe the ceasefire, for which Ankara would be the guarantor. However, we haven't heard anything yet about a ceasefire from Antony Blinken, who has been using the phrase humanitarian pause, which the Turkish side has told him is not enough. Foreign ministers from Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the European Union and the United States are meeting in Tokyo this week to discuss the Middle East conflict, which several global powers have warned could spiral and engulf the Middle East. The G7 bloc of wealthy democracies risks eroding its relevance as a force to tackle major geopolitical crises over an apparent struggle between member nations to agree on a firm, united approach to Israel's war in Gaza. Europeans are divided, and this division is also certainly visible within the G7, said Thomas Gomart, director of the French Institute of International Relations. Complicating matters is that the current chair of the group, Japan, has taken a cautious approach to the crisis, resisting pressure to fall in line with the pro-Israel stance of its closest ally, the United States. Reports from the ground in Gaza show an ever-worsening humanitarian situation, with an estimated more than 20,000 people now massacred by indiscriminate bombing since October the 7th. In a particularly heavy overnight bombing Sunday into this morning, Israel bombed water tanks, United Nations facilities, and a cancer unit for children. At least 88 United Nations air workers have also been murdered. Dr. Hussam Abu Safiya, director of the Children's Hospital at the Kamal Adwan complex in the northern Gaza Strip, says the hospital has been receiving at least 30 corpses and 200 wounded patients daily. He told Al Jazeera that children constitute 70% of the victims of Israeli bombing, including shrapnel wounds and bodies with heads blown off. Abu Safiya stressed that the children will need psychological care after the end of the war, especially those who have lost their families. The past weekend saw millions of people all over the world take to the streets in support of a ceasefire and Palestinian human rights in a show of support unprecedented in recent times. In London's Trafalgar Square, there was a solemn vigil for the children massacred, where the Anglo-Jewish comedian Alexei Sale made the following speech.
In 2014, the Israelis killed what we thought was then the unprecedented number of 500 children in Gaza. A lobby group in Israel wanted to broadcast their names on the radio. The Israeli government changed the law so that they couldn't. So a great supporter of ours, Michael Rosen, wrote a poem. And this is the poem. It's called Don't Mention the Children. Don't mention the children. Don't name the dead children. The people must not know the names of the dead children. The names of the children must be hidden. The children must be nameless. The children must leave this world having no names. No one must know the names of the dead children. No one must say the names of the dead children. No one must even think that the children have names. People must understand that it would be dangerous to know the names of the children. The people must be protected from knowing the names of the children. The names of the children could spread like wildfire. The people would not be safe if they knew the names of the children. Don't name the dead children. Don't remember the dead children. Don't think of the dead children. Don't say dead children.
Layan Abed, 9 years old. Elia Muhammad Ilewa, 9 years old. Farah Yassin, 9 years old. Farah Yassin, 9 years old. Al-Bara Yassin, 9 years. Arij Radwan, 9 years. Abdul Karim Radwan, 7 years. Manal Ilewa, 7 years. Al-Muntasir Yassin, 7 years. Uday Abed, 7 years. Muhammad Abu Libda, 7 years. Sama Radwan, 7 years.
And of course, we had names there of just a tiny handful of the thousands of children murdered by Israel in the last couple of weeks. With attention finally turning to the Middle East after years of neglect, the West Bank has also come into focus. An Israeli government request for 24,000 assault rifles from the United States is drawing scrutiny from American lawmakers and some State Department officials who fear the weapons may very well end up in the hands of violent settlers and civil militias trying to force Palestinians from their land in the West Bank, where violence has been surging. The three proposed tranches of semi-automatic and automatic rifles are valued at $34 million and are being ordered directly from American gunmakers, but they require State Department approval and congressional notification. Israel says the rifles would be used by the National Police Force, but has also indicated that they could be given to civilians. The truth is that Palestinians in the West Bank have been relentlessly targeted for intimidation and harassment by both settlers and occupation forces for many years. Here now is the testimony of one Israeli soldier detailing the tactics used to terrorize innocent civilians.
I have a new unit in town. They just finished training. The first time they're deployed, you don't want the first arrest operation they carry out to be the real thing. So you send them on a mock arrest before. You choose the most peaceful, quiet Palestinian village in the area where you served. Open an aerial photo of the village. Choose a random house in the village. Pick up the phone. Call the Secret Service. Make sure that the guy living in the house you've chosen randomly is innocent. And that by operating on him, you are not interfering in intelligence gathering operations that the Secret Service has in the area. Once you get the go, meaning he's innocent and you're not interfering in Secret Service business in the area, you come in the middle of the night, you surround the house, grab the guy, handcuffed, blindfolded, as if it's a real arrest, put him in a Jeep. After 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, someone goes on the radio, says, end of exercise, stop the Jeep, release the guy, go back to the base and go to sleep. So you're probably wondering, why the hell to do it? Actually, soldiers who get these orders usually also wonder why the hell we're doing it. We know the guy's innocent, so why we're doing it? And they asked their commanders, and you know what many soldiers heard back? Mainly two reasons. One is training. As close training can be to reality, better. So if you can do it on a real Palestinian village, on a real Palestinian house, on a real Palestinian man, better. But the second reason is even more interesting. Think of it, a mock arrest is just another advanced way of making your presence felt. You go in the middle of the night to the village, surround the house, some noise, some movement, lights, shouting, military movement in the village, people wake up, they know you're here. They see you're arresting a person that they know is innocent. They're not stupid. Yeah, people in the village usually know. So they start to ask questions. Why the hell are you arresting him? He's innocent. But then they see that you released him. So what the hell is going on here? Arrest, released. Is he a collaborator? Yes, no. And they don't find the answer, so they're even more scared. When you know what's waiting behind a corner, you can calculate. When you have no idea what's waiting around the corner, that's when you're really terrified, right? Because when the goal is intimidation, the lack of logic is the perfect logic. Prevention is a reality of constant intimidation of everyone, everywhere, all the time. There is nothing a Palestinian can do in order not to be intimidated.
We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, our focus turns to Sudan, where an approximate 6 million people have been displaced by the war there. We'll be right back after this short break.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
A lot is being made of the big storms that are slamming the United Kingdom right now, but they are an interesting precursor to the winter. Back in the winter of 2009-2010, major storms started pounding away in Northwest Europe, and then eventually they spread inland during the month of November. And what that was a signal of was that the upper air jet stream was beginning to cut underneath, beginning to look for its winter position. Now, last year, much of the time, it went up to the north of everybody, so it was a very warm winter across much of Europe. But this year, it looks like it's going to cut into the south, and it's going to be blocking over the top. What's blocking? Well, that's high pressure that tries to develop over Scandinavia and back toward Greenland, which turns the mean wind more northeast than normal across much of northern Europe into the UK, and leads to the colder winter. So the big rainstorms don't just mean it's raining now. They may mean something later on down the road and may not be rain. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you've got.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Researcher Elizabeth Woodworth has examined numerous areas of suppressions by TNI with respect to COVID. TNI partners, including Facebook and Twitter, silenced views about a SARS-2 connection to the Wuhan Biosafety Labs before relenting many months later. Other areas of suppression include denial of early treatments for COVID and censorship of health professionals. Those censored include Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, epidemiologist, Stanford University, and Dr. Robert Malone, inventor of mRNA technology platform, and many more. TNI vigorously censored frontline physicians who have saved thousands of lives with early COVID-19 treatments. Dr. Zelenko in New York, Drs. George Farid and Brian Tyson in California, America's Frontline Doctors, founded by Dr. Simone Gold, and the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, FCCCA, led by ICU critical care physician Dr. Pierre Corey.
From world news to global policies and beyond, this is Compass with Basil Valentine on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And welcome back to the program today, Monday, the 6th of November. With the ongoing genocide in Gaza sending shockwaves through the region, wars elsewhere in the world, particularly in Sudan, are in danger of being overlooked altogether. For more than 6 months, the conflict between the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, has raged across Sudan, leading to mass displacement, shortages of food and medicine, and even cases of ethnic cleansing. Saudi Arabia and the United States have resumed joint efforts in Jeddah to get the feuding parties to reach a settlement after several ceasefires collapsed in recent months. However, the conflict is complicated by the porous borders and instability that characterize the wider region. Experts say that Sudan has become a magnet for fighters from across Africa's Sahel, a belt of territory between the Sahara Desert to the north and the savannas and tropical forests to the south, spanning 12 African nations from Mali in the west to Sudan in the east. Sudan's conflict has displaced about 6 million people, both internally and across international borders, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. The result of this influx of young men, many driven to desperation by other conflicts and lost livelihoods in their own countries, has potentially significant implications for the security dynamics of the wider African continent, the Middle East, and beyond. These forces are not fighting for a cause, but simply for a paycheck, which means they have no regard for civilian life or property, said Cameron Hudson, a senior associate at the Africa Program at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies, who was speaking to Arab News. The Sahel, home to about 135 million people, has a semi-arid climate and is characterized by seasonal rainfall and drought-prone conditions. Though rich in minerals, it grapples with extreme poverty, primarily because of poor leadership, corruption, and geopolitical factors. A rash of military coups in Mali, Burkina Faso, and most recently Niger, combined with long-running insurgencies orchestrated by Islamist militant groups affiliated with Daesh and Al-Qaeda, have led to further destabilization. Sudan itself has become a magnet for fighters from across Africa's Sahel, with the regional economies in no shape to create jobs for a booming youth population. The Sahel is increasingly a source of recruits, both willing and unwilling, to cater for a multitude of conflicts, to say nothing of endemic violence, small arms proliferation, and violent extremism. Anecdotal evidence suggests that many fighters from Chad, the Central African Republic, Libya, and Sudan's Darfur region have converged on the devastated Sudanese capital, Khartoum, to join the RSF ranks. On Saturday, the RSF claimed to have taken control of the army headquarters in West Darfur's capital, El Geneina. The group now wields significant influence in Darfur, where it seized control of Niala, Sudan's second largest city, on October the 26th, and an army base on October the 30th. The capture of territory, resources and spaces to train new recruits stands to strengthen the RSF further. But in order to extend its grip across the country, it requires additional manpower. Sudan has been in the throes of internal strife since April the 15th, when fighting broke out between the SAF, led by the country's de facto military ruler, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and his deputy-turned-rival, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, head of the RSF. To date, the conflict has claimed more than 9,000 lives, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, a non-profit. Civilians are bearing the brunt of the crisis, with many caught in the crossfire, targeted for their ethnicity, and either robbed, raped, or dying as a result of food shortages and lack of access to medical assistance. Both sides accuse each other of abuses and blocking humanitarian access. The RSF itself is a complex coalition of state-sponsored militias, local armed groups, and foreign mercenaries. Its core consists of nomadic Arabs from Sudan's west, supplemented by Chadian Arab and non-Arab auxiliaries from the Sahel and Sahara regions. Groups from Sudan's far west, such as the RSF-aligned Tamazuj, or Third Front, have joined the fray. The stated aim of the Tamazui, which consists primarily of Arabs from Darfur and Kordofan, is to end their perceived marginalization. However, this rough tribal coalition is far from united, as throughout the ages, local Arab tribes have often been at loggerheads over power and ownership of resources. Ideologically, the RSF lacks a clear unifying political program, said Reem Abbas, a Sudanese author and political analyst. Motivations range from ethnic grievances to a desire for regime change, and some fighters are drawn by the charismatic leadership of Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. Others fight out of sheer necessity, seeing no alternative livelihoods other than as soldiers for hire. The latest in the war now in this report.
In Sudan, there are signs that the conflict ravaging the country since April is escalating further, despite peace talks in Saudi Arabia. The Rapid Support Forces, the paramilitary group fighting the army, say they have seized control of army bases in El Janina, the capital of West Darfur State. This cements their takeover of a city, which they've been accused of ethnic killings, and it also increases their control of Sudan's western region of Darfur. Meanwhile, thousands of refugees fleeing the violence in Darfur have arrived in neighboring Chad. Aid workers say they're joining hundreds of thousands of others who got out of Sudan since April. In El Janina, the RSF and allied Arab militias are being accused by local residents of targeted ethnic killings, looting homes and markets, and even raping women. The RSF leadership denies the accusations and says any soldiers found guilty of violations will be brought to justice. The Sudanese Alliance, an armed group allied to the Sudanese army, conceded the losses in Darfur but said it would continue to fight the RSF. The Sudanese army has not yet commented. Well, as fear grows that the RSF's western expansion may escalate the conflict further, there are now also question marks over the country's unity. CGTN's Naba Mordeen reports from Port Sudan.
The Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, are gaining ground in Sudan's western region of Darfur. They are reported to be penetrating and controlling much of the vast area and have taken over strategic cities like Niala. Security experts say this is a brand new threat to the unity of Sudan. 12 years after South Sudan formally broke away after decades of civil war, experts are comparing it to the current division in Libya.
The Libyan scenario is expected. The RSF militia have moved and are trying to control the Darfur region to use it as a bargaining chip to negotiate for power. That negotiating tool is the threat of secession of Darfur, and it will be followed by a long civil war if the situation remains the same.
The RSF is being accused of fueling tribal conflicts in the Darfur region. The UN has called the violence there genocide, following reports of widespread killing, rape and displacement, and the RSF seems intent on securing its gains in the West.
Despite the fighting continuing in Khartoum, reports have confirmed the withdrawal of large numbers of RSF troops from the capital in recent days. This is expected to boost RSF raids in Western Sudan and the Darfur region.
The raids that started in Western Darfur's Al Jenina a couple of months ago are now expanding towards the other four Darfur states along Kordofan. Last month, the RSF took control of Sudan's second biggest city, Niala. It's now attacking military bases in Al Fashir, Zalinje, Balila, and Al Ubayd. Analysts say outside intervention is now crucial in ending the conflict.
If the United States and Saudi Arabia succeed in neutralizing the regional parties who are connected with the two warring factions, it could prevent foreign intervention and the extension of the conflict, and that will pave the way for a successful secession and end the conflict gradually.
Initial indirect talks to mediate between the two warring factions and ultimately stop the war continue in Jeddah. However, the future of Sudan's unity remains uncertain. Naba Muhyiddin, CGTN, Port Sudan.
Uganda's president has downplayed the United States' decision to expel the East African country from a major trade deal. Last week, Joe Biden announced Uganda and three other countries will be dropped from the African Growth and Opportunity Act, known as AGOA. The US had previously said it might take such action after Uganda passed a tough new anti-homosexuality law. On Sunday, President Yoweri Museveni urged Ugandans not to be over-concerned. Some of these actors in the Western world overestimate themselves and underestimate the freedom fighters of Africa, he said on the X platform. Introduced in the year 2000, AGOA gives eligible sub-Saharan African countries duty-free access to the United States for more than 1,800 products. Under this deal, Uganda has been exporting goods like coffee and textiles to the United States for years without paying any import tax, but that is set to end. More now on the importance of AGOA to Africa in this report from ENCA.
Now, for 3 days at the Johannesburg Expo Center, African trade ministers, business people, civil society and trade unions debated the future of the trade agreement between Africa and the United States that is due to expire in September 2025. The call made to the U.S. administration is for the trade agreement to be extended speedily, as uncertainty over its future has made investors press the pause button on current investments. ENCA senior reporter Aviwe Mtila covered the AGOA forum and filed this report.
Particularly keen to get the reauthorization in the earliest part of 2024.
African trade ministers are speaking in unison at the 20th AGOA forum, pushing for the early extension of the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which assists over 30 African countries to improve economic relations with the United States. The current agreement comes to an end on the 30th of September, 2025.
So there have been many conversations to say, look, can we give an extension to this? Because under the AGOA facility, many African countries have seen close to 80 to 90% of their products entering the American market duty-free. But if it comes to an end at an abrupt position, what will happen? Will we be able to export to the American market? Will we be able to meet the standards? Will SMEs have grown enough to do that?
Countries such as Namibia only developed our utilization strategy and action plan 2 years ago. And it would be of great loss if we are to face this out in the next 1 year and a half, because we believe we still have a long way to go. We only started with the export of our first phase of products. We are still to go in the second phase of products and the third long-term products that we would want to infuse in the USA market.
Experts suggest AGOA trade is also crucial for South Africa.
AGOA is also important for our country because South Africa is the biggest exporter on the African continent to the United States. And a number of sectors in our important sectors in an economy, such as the automotive sector, have benefited immensely from AGOA. So it's important that we renew it on acceptable terms, that we expand the scope of AGOA. These are all very important elements.
It's very important for AGOA to be extended because small businesses are getting not only an opportunity to exhibit but to trade. And now as we're talking about the products that we have seen here, more than 400 companies that are showcasing their stories here, and now they need access to markets. Therefore, if AGOA continues, it tells that we're not only tapping into trading opportunities, but we're also growing our tech space here at home.
In a short statement released on day one of the forum, the U.S. president said he had encouraged Congress to reauthorize AGOA in a timely fashion.
The American people and especially leaders believe that AGOA is absolutely crucial to not just Africa's future, but to the U.S.'s future. We have to have this partnership in place. And I believe, and I think the president believes this as well, that he's done more than enough to show the American people that we're going to stick by AGOA and we're going to stick with him as president.
The existence of AGOA has helped to support the broader framework of trade, including U.S. access to critical minerals. Let me give just a few examples. Chromium, 97% of the chromium that the United States imports comes from the African continent. Ruthenium, 52% of American imports comes from the continent. Iridium, 52%. Rhodium, 39%. Platinum, 35%. Palladium, 33%. What they illustrate is that these are important inputs into American industrialization.
The minister says 155,000 American jobs have been created as a result of trade with the African continent. The decision to extend the AGOA trade agreement now lies with the U.S. Congress. Aviwe Mtila, Johannesburg.
And finally today, access to resources, and in particular rare earth minerals, is one of the key areas of economic growth amidst technological change in the 21st century. The search for and subsequent exploitation of such minerals is a key area of environmental concern as well, as we can hear now in this report from NHK World.
And global demand is skyrocketing for critical minerals such as lithium that are essential for the production of electric vehicle batteries. The European Union is working to ensure a stable supply of these resources as competition intensifies. But there are concerns about environmental harm from mining.
Minister, how are you today?
The International Energy Agency, in September, held its first meeting to discuss critical minerals. Major consuming nations, such as Japan, the U.S., and European countries, met with major producing nations, including Indonesia and Australia. And they agreed to cooperate to secure a stable supply of critical minerals.
If the world relies on one single country, one single energy route, one single company, it is always risky. We have to diversify as much as possible.
EVs are becoming increasingly popular in Europe. Global demand for lithium has tripled over the past 5 years. The mineral is an essential element of EV batteries. And the fact remains that China processes and refines 65% of lithium for the global market. To improve this situation, the EU announced its Critical Raw Materials Act this past March. Lithium is among 16 minerals that were categorized as strategic raw materials. The EU set a goal of securing at least 10% of its annual consumption volume from within the European bloc. Countries such as France and Germany are trying to reach this target by solidifying plans to mine lithium. Meanwhile, issues surrounding mining have also emerged. In the Barroso region of northern Portugal, large quantities of lithium have been found.
It's one of the largest promising groups of lithium-bearing veins in Europe.
In May, the Portuguese government approved an environmental impact assessment, and mining is expected to start soon. But local residents are adamantly opposed to any mining. This unspoiled region is recognized for its globally important agricultural heritage systems. Its unique farming methods conserve an abundant water supply for both agriculture and livestock. Farmers are concerned that mining will contaminate rivers and other water sources.
Of course, drilling into rock will affect the environment.
The government seeks to strike a balance between environmental protection and mining development.
Portugal clearly plays an important role in Europe's strategy. If lithium can be developed in a sustainable way, Europe will certainly benefit from it.
The goal is to achieve both the protection of people's farmlands and to secure resources that are essential for clean energy technologies.
And finally today, the appalling statistic has emerged that 1% of Gaza's entire population has been massacred. I'm Basil Valentine. See you same time tomorrow.